This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. What's the most widely smuggled legal substance? Tobacco. The tobacco smuggling business helps fund organized crime and terrorist groups, and according to a new study, the business stretches from counterfeiters in China and renegade factories in Russia to Indian reservations in New York and warlords in Pakistan and North Africa. Here in the U.S., many states are finding their budget crises have been made even worse as a result of lost tax revenues from smuggled cigarettes. Some states are trying to crack down. A series of articles on tobacco, terrorism, and illicit trade has been published as part of the Tobacco Underground Project. The project is an investigation by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, which is a project of the Center for Public Integrity. My guest, David E. Kaplan, is the director of the consortium and the editorial director of its work. David Kaplan, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's just start with the scope of this. Like, how big, in terms of money and number of countries, is the tobacco smuggling business?
Oh, it's massive. You're talking about huge black markets literally all over the planet. At heart, this is really an organized crime story. It's about how these alternate economies have risen in various regions, various countries, and they're feeding crime and corruption. I mean, tobacco is, because it's a legal substance, the penalties aren't as large as they are on narcotics, but the profit margins are just as big. So tobacco has become the world's most widely smuggled legal substance that we've ever seen.
Has the tobacco industry itself been involved in the illicit cigarette trade?
Oh, God, deeply. It really came from them. In the 1990s, there were a series of investigations culminating in one that my group, the ICIJ, did, showing how Big Tobacco had systematically engaged organized crime groups around the world to push smuggled contraband tobacco. And the reasons were to create market share and to save money. See, much of the price of a pack of cigarettes is in taxes. So if you can take cigarettes from a low-tax place, like, say, the Carolinas, and sell it in a high-tax place, like, say, New York, you pocket the difference. That's where these huge profit margins come from.
We'll get more into the tobacco industry a little bit later. But let's look at, like, who else, just an overview, who else is profiting from this black market cigarette industry? Big Tobacco has profited from it. You mentioned the Taliban. Who else?
Well, when you create these big off-the-books economies, pretty much people across the board are profiting. There are huge renegade tobacco companies that have risen up in Eastern Europe, in Russia and Ukraine. In South America, Paraguay has become this tobacco behemoth that's pouring $1 billion of contraband goods into Argentina and Brazil. In our own country, we see large tobacco companies flooding U.S. Indian reservations with untaxed tobacco. And that's okay on its face. The Indians are by law allowed to buy untaxed tobacco. What they're not allowed to do is then turn around and sell it on the black market to bodegas and street corner vendors in New York City and in Canada. And that's going on, again, another $1 billion black market. The problem with these black markets is they create a kind of structural corruption. There's so much money flowing through these off-the-books transactions. Pretty soon you got Hell's Angels involved and the mafia and all kinds of spurious characters overseas.
And let's talk about who's losing money, because there's a lot of tax money not being paid on these illegal cigarettes.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, why really should we care? I mean, it's okay, it's cigarettes, it's basically a legal product, even though it's being smuggled. You really care for three reasons. But one is that it's feeding organized crime and corruption. Two is there's a huge amount of lost tax revenue that states, that governments have to make up elsewhere. Now, New York City, New York State are losing as much as $1 billion a year. And these are governments in crisis that cannot fund basic services. Finally, you care because of the health implications. Studies have shown that high taxes really do discourage smoking. people tend to smoke less when cigarettes are taxed high. And when you flood the market with these black market cigarettes, you undercut that policy and people start smoking more. And who's smoking more? It's people who are in poorer income brackets. It's women. We're seeing explosive growth in developing countries. And all this is related in many ways to the smuggling boom that's going on.
Oh, and smokers are being hurt by this illegal trade in cigarettes because some of the cigarettes that are being sold illegally are also illegally made. They're not brand name cigarettes, although some of them are knockoffs of brand name cigarettes. And they're sometimes higher in nicotine than real legit cigarettes are.
Yeah, if you can believe it, as bad as cigarettes are for you, some of these bootleg smokes are much, much worse. There's all kinds of crud in them. I mean, heavy metals like cadmium and there's arsenic. Studies have found high rates of pesticides, rat poison, even human feces. You have two different categories of these off-the-book cigarettes. One are basically legitimate brands that are untaxed. They don't get the stamps that you're supposed to have, and they just get shipped every which way. This is what Big Tobacco has flooded U.S. Indian reservations with. Another kind are these obscure brands, and you can find them sold everywhere on the Internet, that come out of places like Paraguay and Russia and China, which, you know, they may be produced legitimately in their home countries, but they're completely unregulated, they're untaxed, and in many cases they're counterfeit versions of the packs that we've grown accustomed to seeing. And some of the counterfeiting is really good. I mean, even the industry has trouble figuring out which are the legitimate brands and which aren't. They can even copy like the holographic images that are on Marlboro packs to thwart counterfeiters. There's one village, Yingxiao, in southern China, in Fujian province, that is the world center of counterfeiting. The whole town is dependent on counterfeiting cigarettes, and some of the factories are literally underground. It's just amazing, and they're shipping them in unbelievable numbers overseas. I mean, by the container, by tens of millions of packs at a time. And we've reported on a couple of cases, one involving a billion counterfeit cigarettes from China that came through the U.S. I mean, they really are huge. And you can find them on street corners today and in neighborhood shops, Indian reservations. It's really become quite a phenomenon.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dave Kaplan. He's the editor of the Tobacco Underground Project, which is an investigative research project on tobacco terrorism and the illicit trade in cigarettes. He's the editorial director of the Center for Public Integrity and the director of the Center's International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. What is Big Tobacco doing about these counterfeit cigarettes, these knockoffs coming from China that are sometimes being sold in the U.S.?
They're pretty alarmed. You know, Big Tobacco has come a long way since the 90s, when they were really behind most of the smuggling. Now it's taken on a life of its own. Both Big Tobacco companies have deployed agents around the world. They've got their own intelligence networks. They're trying to get local governments to crack down, but it's pretty well out of control at this point. We think that, gee, I forget the numbers, something like 12% of all sales are now contraband in the worldwide tobacco market. It's almost 700 billion cigarettes. And again, it's hard to tell when you're buying a legitimate brand.
Now, you had said that in the 90s, the tobacco industry itself was deeply involved in cigarette smuggling. Give us an example of how back in the 90s, parts of the tobacco industry got cigarettes to underground groups and to the black market, and how did they make a profit doing that?
We recently ran a piece based on court records that have been coming out in Italy and Switzerland called The Montenegro Connection. Now, Montenegro, if you saw one of the recent James Bond films, it was filmed there. It's a very picturesque small Balkan country on the Adriatic. For some 10 years, it's been ruled by Prime Minister Milo Djukanovic. Mr. Djukanovic, according to these court records, is at the center of a criminal conspiracy involving about $1 billion of contraband cigarettes that he was moving to help support Montenegro during the Balkan Wars and then to fund the state. It was a quasi-state enterprise to move off the books tobacco. He was buying those from the big tobacco companies who had to know. I mean, Montenegro, which only has a few million people, couldn't possibly absorb these huge amounts of tobacco. What was going on, according to court records, is he and his alleged compatriots were selling them to two different Italian mafia syndicates who were then distributing these untaxed cigarettes all through Europe, and they laundered allegedly about $1 billion in Switzerland. Cases being looked at again now because Montenegro wants to join the European Union, and their biggest concerns about little Montenegro are, well, crime and corruption.
I still don't completely get it, how like a country like Montenegro can buy cigarettes at such a discount that there could be so many middlemen in between and still people making profits every step along the way.
Well, they can buy the cigarettes for as little as $2-3 a pack. I mean, that's what cigarettes cost without the tax. I mean, you can buy them for under $1 in some countries. But then if you sell them in a high-priced country like say Norway or the UK, they're going to cost $8-9 a pack. I think they're about $7 in New York. You don't have to sell them at exactly that rate, but gee, if you're paying $2 wholesale and then you turn around and sell it for $5, which is still a much better deal than the retail price, you're more than doubling your profit. So these cigarettes are sold untaxed and on the black market. And that's where these big markups come from.
And Montenegro was getting their cigarettes from legit cigarette manufacturers, the big brand name companies.
Exactly, yeah.
So the
yeah.
big brand name companies were making their profits on it too.
Well, they were happy to move product and they were creating market share. More people are smoking. That means a bigger future market. They use that for market penetration. And in mainland China, they use triad criminal organizations to move product that way. You know, more people smoking is better for business.
You said that the big tobacco companies had a big part in tobacco smuggling in the sense that they were selling huge amounts of cigarettes to places like Montenegro, probably knowing that they'd be used in the underground business. Yes, they probably knew that.
Oh, there's no doubt. I think court records reflect this, as do our own investigations. If you look at what's happening in the U.S. right now, I mean, we've got a map on our site which shows how many cigarettes American Indians on New York reservations would have to smoke to account for all the cigarettes that big tobacco has been selling to them. You know, I mean, some reservations, it's like a cigarette every, 30 seconds. It's impossible to account for the numbers of cigarettes that have flooded these various places, like the reservations, like Montenegro in the 90s, and like Paraguay is doing to Brazil and Argentina today. So we've just looked at all these different markets, and billions and billions of cigarettes are just disappearing. They're disappearing into these black markets that are creating just a real health nightmare.
Now, why have Indian reservations in Canada and the United States been involved in the underground cigarette trade?
It's lucrative. Many reservations have had a challenging time creating good livelihoods for their people, and this has been a proven way to make some real money on the reservation. And we calculated it's about $1 billion black market. So $1 billion is suddenly off the books. That has implications. It has implications for law enforcement, for health policy, for lost tax revenue. It's serious stuff.
New York's Governor David Patterson last December signed legislation designed to stop the underground cigarette trade coming out of Native American reservations in New York. Can you tell us about that legislation?
Well, New York's gone at this again and again, and there, it's been a problem from the get-go. And the reason is that the Indians, particularly Mohawk reservations, are quite adamant that they have a right to sell these cigarettes untaxed. And the state and the city of New York dispute this, and they believe they're losing hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in needed tax revenue. But the last time they tried to crack down, I think there were Indian blockades and threats of violence, and the state is not interested in provoking a crisis with their Native American population. So there's been an uneasy truce, and the result is that the cigarette black market has grown and grown. And this last legislation passed by New York State was an attempt to crack down on this, but we don't see any real intent on putting real teeth into enforcement. And the reason is they don't want to provoke a confrontation with the Indians.
You said in the 90s that the big tobacco companies played a major part in the underground cigarette business. Why? And that implies that they no longer play a big part. What changed? Was it lawsuits against them?
Yeah, exactly. There were big lawsuits in the United States and Canada and the EU. There's one in Colombia that is reaching a conclusion right now, where the tobacco industry has had to pay billions of dollars for pushing an unhealthy product and covering up evidence about its effects, but actively encouraging smuggling. And they've had to make deals, and they've had to make pledges that they would clean up their act. In many cases, they have, and I think they decided it was no longer in their best interest to be so deeply involved in smuggling. Now, that's not entirely the case. We got a piece we just published on Ukraine in Eastern Europe, where there's like 30 billion cigarettes that are overproduced by big tobacco companies in Ukraine. Well, where do they think those are going? They're all being sold on the black market in the EU, where they get huge amounts. And we interviewed representatives of the big tobacco industry in Ukraine. They were surprisingly frank about what's going on. But basically the attitude is, look, we produce it. It's not our job to police it. But the evidence is pretty clear that they end up in the black market.
One of the interesting stories that the Tobacco Underground Project has investigated is jingling cigarettes, which is the first cigarette manufactured and designed explicitly for smuggling. Tell us what jingling cigarettes are and where they're made.
Gee, I love this story, not just methodologically, because I've been an investigative reporter for 30 years, and it was this transnational underground empire that we penetrated and put the story together for the first time, but the scale was extraordinary. 3 years ago, this outfit didn't even exist. It was a company called the Baltic Tobacco Factory. And it shows you how quickly things can change in a globalized world. From virtually nothing, this outfit started pouring about $1 billion of cigarettes into the European Union. They're called Jinling, which is actually a Chinese name. It's the old name for Nanjing, ancient Chinese city. And somehow it ends up the brand in Russia. These factories start producing it, and it costs a fraction of what the big brands, the name brands in Europe cost because of high taxes. So they started pouring Jinling cigarettes all over the EU. And as we look, we went from country to country. Suddenly, from nothing, Jinlings had become the second most seized cigarette, next to Marlboros, in the EU.
So are these officially illegal cigarettes, or are they just kind of cheap ones designed for smuggling? Are the cigarettes themselves illegal?
No. And that's the dilemma with so much of this. You know, I mean, cigarettes are a legal product. It's under law, it's okay for people to, you know, of age to smoke cigarettes. The problem is when they're either counterfeit or they're untaxed and unregulated. These were untaxed and unregulated, so they would take these cheap Jinling cigarettes and smuggle them across various borders in Europe and then sell them on the black market, sell them untaxed. And suddenly, Jinling cigarettes were flooding these places, and nobody had heard of Jinling. I mean, we may see similar operations here in the U.S. If you start seeing strange brands coming in, and you can find them on the internet. Go ahead and Google Jinling, J-I-N-L-I-N-G. You'll get a lot of hits.
What do the packages look like?
They look like camels. There's a picture on our site. But instead of a camel, there's a goat. the design. And we did the project. You know, ICIJ, our international consortium, works with partners around the world. And one of our partners on this was Novaya Gazeta, the gutsy weekly in Moscow. And the name of their story is Who Will Answer for Our Goats?
One of the groups that is profiting from the underground sales of cigarettes is the Taliban. So let's talk a little bit about how the Taliban are profiting from cigarettes. Where do they get their cut?
Well, we zeroed in on the Pakistan Taliban in particular because there's a very large and lucrative tobacco industry in Pakistan's northwest frontier, which has been in the news so much with people. Intelligence experts think that's where bin Laden may be hiding. The Taliban has tried to take over swaths of Pakistan territory. And how are they funding themselves? Part of it is through heroin shipments. They tax the shipments as they come from Afghanistan into Pakistan. If you're coming through this territory, well, the Taliban have arms. They control key passages, and if you're going to bring it through, you have to pay them a tax. They're doing the same thing with cigarettes, and Pakistan intelligence officials told us that second only to heroin, the Pakistan Taliban are profiting from the cigarette industry. And there have been studies that look at why some conflicts last longer than others. And there's a category called contraband finance, whether it's narcotics like heroin and opium or blood diamonds, or illegal timber harvesting, or illicit tobacco smuggling. When they fuel civil wars and insurgencies and other conflicts, they tend to last as much as 5-6 times longer than conflicts that aren't fueled by these criminal sources of income. So it's another reason the trade is troublesome.
So are the Taliban basically like demanding protection money from tobacco, from cigarette manufacturers and cigarette smugglers in Pakistan?
Yeah, that's exactly what's going on. It's a protection racket where they get fees not to interfere and to allow safe passage. And in fact, we found the same thing is going on with Al-Qaeda's franchise in North Africa. They're allowing safe passage through these ancient smuggling routes that go from West Africa through the Sahara into the north. It's safe passage money and very lucrative.
It's taken you a team of international journalists through the Tobacco Underground Project, which is part of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. So it's this international team that tracked down what's going on, that investigated what's going on. Will it take, similarly, an international global crackdown on this illegal trade to actually do anything about it? Is it too difficult for individual countries to really accomplish anything that would stop the global trade?
This is actually a solvable problem. It took some initiative on our part to put the big story together. But the problem in these, when you allow these kind of black markets to fester and to expand, they create their, how should I say it, they take on a life of their own. And they become the criminal economies become institutionalized. It's the same principle where they start fueling conflicts overseas, these sources of contraband, and it becomes very hard to rip out that sort of plumbing.
You've been working on a lot of different projects, and a lot of them have to do with terror networks in one way or another. Even in the tobacco thing, there are terror networks that profit off of the tobacco trade. So you're getting to see this, almost aerial view of what's going on because you're researching so many different cross-border projects, many of them related to terrorism. So I'm wondering if you're seeing patterns that you think a lot of other people aren't seeing?
Well, I don't know.
Or interconnectedness?
Yeah. I don't know if I'm seeing and other people aren't, but I started as a crime reporter, and they're all crime stories to me. I mean, even I was covering Al-Qaeda before 9/11 for U.S. News and World Report. I went to East Africa after the embassies were bombed, and these were criminal conspiracies. They're criminal organizations. That's what terrorist cells are. They have different motives. You know, organized crime functions because of profit. These people love to make lots of money very quickly. You know, the terrorists tend to function because of political or religious reasons. So the motives are different, but the MOs are very similar. They're using safe houses. They're smuggling products. They're moving contraband goods. They're smuggling arms. They use violence to enforce their way. And I guess I see this as all one continuum. Even though the motives are different, it's I'm almost at the point here where you have to clean up the whole world. You can't just take on organized crime or take on terrorism or take on cigarette smuggling. I mean, you have to clean up dirty money. You have to develop and educate societies. You have to create transparency and accountability and civil society and in these various cultures. I mean, that's what's really going to do it.
Well, good luck to you, and thank you so much for talking with us about the Tobacco Project.
A real pleasure. Thanks so much.
David E. Kaplan is the director of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, which is part of the Center for Public Integrity. You can find a link to their Tobacco Underground project on our website, freshair.npr.org. Joey Gallo is part of gangster lore. Bob Dylan sang about him in his ballad, King of the Streets. Joey Gallo also inspired Jimmy Breslin's comic novel about bumbling gangsters called The Gang That Couldn't Shoot Straight. Gallo was gunned down in Manhattan's Little Italy in 1972. Now there's a new biography of him called The Mad Ones, Crazy Joe Gallo and the Revolution at the Edge of the Underworld. It's by Tom Folsom, who interviewed people who knew Gallo and read through almost 1,500 pages of unpublished FBI files on him, files based on wiretaps of underworld conversations. Folsom also co-authored Nicky Barnes' memoir about his life as a drug kingpin. Barnes was portrayed by Cuba Gooding Jr. in the film American Gangster. Tom Folsom, welcome to Fresh Air. Your book starts by saying that the tale of the Gallo brothers has been recounted in the lore and legend of New York City crime, but you felt that no nonfiction book had captured the madness of the Gallos. What do you mean by that?
Well, you look at a guy like Joey's life, and you wonder what's the thread here. You know, he's more than just an ordinary hood. You know, in the early 60s, he moves to Greenwich Village at the same time as Bob Dylan. This is in 1961. He gets caught up in the fervor of Greenwich Village. He gets caught up in the spirit of wanting to create, of wanting to paint, to write. He's hobnobbing with high society in the early 70s, guys like Jerry Orbach. You know, he gets a book deal from Viking Press. He's quite literally the toast of the town in the months before he gets whacked outside of Umberto's clam house.
It's just odd to me. You know, he's reading Kerouac. He's reading, you know, the existential novelists and, you know, identifying with all this. And I'm wondering, like, what exactly is he getting out of it? Does he see himself as, like, a beatnik murderer or an existential extortionist? I mean, how does all this, like, deep reading that he's doing relate to what he's doing in real life, which is, you know, he's a hitman, he's a mobster, he's trying to overthrow the crime family and take control himself?
Joey Gallo was a frequenter of the 8th Street bookshop in Greenwich Village. It's percolating in the coffee shops around this time, you know, when you've got the beatniks talking about whether or not a guy like Fidel Castro is hip or square. There's stirrings of revolution that we'll see later in the course of the 60s come to fruition. But Joey picks up on that early, and this idea that the enemy is the establishment, and Joey's seeing the establishment as the mafia. So, you know, Joey will incorporate things, you know, when he goes to Six and, like, in the 1960s, he starts creating alliances with black nationalist groups. with heroin dealers like Nicky Barnes. They forge alliances in the joint, and they make plans to, you know, do things like control the distribution of heroin in New York City. Now, it's very significant that a guy like Joey Gallo is reaching out to a black heroin dealer like Nicky Barnes, because this was just something that wasn't done in the mafia. Sometimes Sicilian only, you know, maybe put some Neapolitans in, but this is a very Italian-dominated organization. So Joey's he's got some revolutionary ideas of where he wants to take street crime.
So Joey Gallo became a made man in the Profaci family. What was the Profaci family like?
When you talk about a character like Joe Profaci, the Don, it's helpful to think of Don Corleone, the Godfather. They called Joseph Profaci the olive oil king because at the time he was America's largest importer of olive oil. He had ruled South Brooklyn really since about, I'd say, the 1930s. He was a force to be feared, and he demanded really strict discipline for the members of his family, and he did what was called wetting the beak. This is something that's famously told about in Godfather II, which is that the Don he's going to take his cut of the profits of the underlings. So for a guy for a guy like Joey Gallo, who's collecting the nickels and dimes off the jukebox industry, the Don he's taking a pretty hefty cut of the Gallo's profits. So therefore, this was a source of contention for the Gallo brothers when they decided to revolt against the Don.
In one story that you tell that has resonance in fiction, both with The Godfather and also The Sopranos, the Gallo's hitman, Joey Jelly, is taken to Sheepshead Bay in Brooklyn. And this is by one of the rival gangs. And what happens? Who takes him and what happens?
Joe Jelly, he is the Gallo's bodyguard. He's got a reputation as the most feared hitman in Brooklyn. In the midst of the Gallo-Profaci negotiations, where we're not sure what's going on here in the Gallo War, are they fighting or they're not? There's a very uneasy truce in the summer of 1961 when Joe Jelly decides he's going to go on a deep sea fishing trip with some of his buddies. Joe Jelly never comes back, but a few days later, there's a mysterious car driving by the Gallo family diner. It's a place called Jackie's in Flatbush. And out of the back seat of this car comes a package. Inside the package are Joe Jelly's clothes wrapped around a dead fish. Of course, the line is Joe Jelly sleeps with the fishes.
So it's not just that they drowned the hitman in Sheepshead Bay. They did a lot worse than that.
Yeah, as the FBI reports say, they cut off his arms and legs, stuffed him in a barrel, and tossed it into Sheepshead Bay. And one report even says that the barrel actually floated back up and had to be weighed down even further so it would really sink.
So Joey Gallo is sentenced to prison, convicted
right.
of conspiracy and attempted extortion in 1961 for trying to take over a check cashing business. He's sentenced to 7 to 14 years. So is the war still going on between the Profaci and family and the Gallo brothers when Joey goes off to prison?
Well, there's a truce that's called when Joe Colombo becomes the Don of the family. He makes some concessions with the Gallo brothers. Joey, of course, he says, you know, it doesn't apply to me because I'm in prison at this time. His time in prison in the 1960s is really his time to get his intellectual ammunition for the fight. This is when he really starts to become increasingly radicalized. You have bank robber Willie Sutton telling a really colorful story about how Joey Gallo is walking around with one of Mao's little red books, and he's talking about the fact that all the prisoners need to join in the revolution. This is very much in keeping with what Joey Gallo does when he teams up, so to speak, with Harlem heroin dealer Nicky Barnes. By teaming up, I mean that what Joey Gallo does is he starts to forge this alliance with Nicky Barnes because he realizes that if I could get a guy like Nicky and I can teach him the ways of the mafia, and a guy like Nicky, I wrote this book, Mr. Untouchable, with in Witness Protection, so Nicky told me this story personally, is that Joey wants a guy like Nicky to create his own sort of mafia as this vehicle for distributing heroin across New York City. For Joey, he's thinking, well, if the Gallo brothers can team up with Nicky Barnes' group, then we're going to be able to rule the streets.
So when Joey Gallo's in prison and he's reading more books from the 8th Street bookstore that are shipped to him, he's making alliances with African-American gangsters and heroin dealers like Nicky Barnes. And he's increasingly identifying with this uprising against the bourgeois oppressors of the world. And, God, there's part of me that thinks, like, this is so ridiculous. Like, the bourgeois oppressors of the world that he wants to overthrow is a crime family that's taking too big a take of the money that he's stealing from people.
Right, right.
It's just, like, something so irritating about the whole thing of him kind of identifying with these larger, like, intellectual and political social ideas.
Yeah, I mean, this is really a tale of the absurdity of not only just, you know, America's love with gangsters, but you know where this it was part of the joy in writing this book as a writer. I just found it fascinating how Joey's taking the zeitgeist and he's twisting it to his own ends,
exactly,
for criminal means.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's absolutely infuriating, but it certainly makes for good reading, and it was a kick to write about.
While Joey Gallo was in prison, the Colombo family became very powerful, and his brothers became part of that family. Why?
Well, essentially what happened is Joe Colombo takes over the mantle of Don of what was the Profaci family, which is now called the Colombo family. Joe Colombo makes concessions to the Gallo brothers, saying that, well, we're going to give you this and that. And these concessions really, they never seem to come through as the years go on. So when Joey Gallo comes out of prison and he sees Joe Colombo not giving the Gallo brothers the respect he feels that it deserves, he very quickly re-sparks the mafia war, and the Gallo brothers go to the mattresses again against the Don.
So when Joey gets out of prison, he wants to take down the Colombo family. He wants to take
right.
out particularly Joe Colombo. And Joe Colombo is shot. He remains in a coma for years and then dies. And Joey is suspected of being the man who hired the hitman. Why is Joey suspected?
Well, Joey's suspected of being the hitman because it's an African-American that guns down Colombo. And the papers immediately seize on the fact that Joey was in prison making alliances, you know, with heroin dealers like Nicky Barnes. He was reaching out to black nationalist groups. And as a result, you know, the Colombo family holds a kangaroo court, and they indict Joey for this murder because of the fact that a black man was the one who gunned down Colombo.
Do you think that Joey Gallo was behind the killing and that the gunman was hired by Gallo?
It's tough to say. There's evidence on both sides. But these hits were done by professionals, and they made it so where you wouldn't find out. So I don't think there's really any way of getting to the bottom of these mafia mysteries, so to speak. But what was significant in the Joey Gallo story is that whether or not he did it, he was pinned for doing the murder. And as a result, there's an open contract on his life.
So describe the scene of his murder.
Well, I think it's significant to go back to the night that he's going out to the Copacabana on his 43rd birthday. And he goes to the Copacabana with his wife. They've just been married 3 weeks ago. This was a marriage covered in the New York Post. You know, Earl Wilson, Midnight Earl, sends one of his people down to cover the weddings. You know, Joey's very much a society item as he's coming to the Copacabana to celebrate his 43rd birthday. He looks out on the stage and he sees Don Rickles there doing his act. Don Rickles makes acknowledgement to Joey. Everybody looks up. They even laugh when they see Joey Gallus. You know, he's there in his pinstripe suit because John Rickles makes a joke at his expense. So, but Joey Gallo is quite literally, he's the toast of the town at this point. He's got intellectuals like Susan Sontag, who, you know, she's dying to meet Joey Gallo. He's David Steinberg, who now directs Curbs Your Enthusiasm. He was the best man at Joey Gallo's wedding. Jerry Orbach, who played Joey Gallo in the game that couldn't shoot straight. He was actually a character based on Joey Gallo, Kid Sally Palumbo. Jerry Orbach is, he and Joey are their best pals. They're really tight. So Joey's really got what he wants in terms of all of his intellectual aspirations, his idea that he wanted to be an artist. He wanted to be a writer. You know, he secured a book deal. So Joey's kind of got it made. And a few hours later, he's at Umberto's Clam House for some late night snacks with his family. And in comes the hitman and he gets gunned down.
So what mark would you say, what kind of like legacy would you say that Joey Gallo left in the world of organized crime?
Well, I think in the world of organized crime, you know, there's a line in Goodfellas, which I think really speaks to this. It talks about, you know, a young Henry Hill is looking at the heyday of the mafia, and he's, you know, seeing all the wise guys, and they're really living it up, and you know, the world is theirs. And he says, well, this is in the days before Joe Gallo decides to take on a boss. I think what happened after the Gallo War is that the young Turks of the mafia decided, well, you know, they're not going to treat their Don as, you know, as the Pope, as the God anymore here. You know, if we don't like what the Don's doing, we're going to revolt. And so this was something that eroded discipline in the mafia. So I think that in part is Joey Gallo's you know, legacy to organized crime.
Well, Tom Folsom, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Tom Folsom is the author of The Mad Ones, Crazy Joe Gallo, and The Revolution at the Edge of the Underworld. This year marked the 30th anniversary of the Montreal Jazz Festival. Music critic Milo Miles attended the first few days of the event in early July and discovered many unexpected musical pleasures.
Although some people complain about it, one of the best things about music festivals is that they don't stick tightly to their stated format. Lots of performers show up who have little or no relation to the official style of music. For example, I recently attended the first 5 days of the Festival International de Jazz de Montreal. But I'm here to celebrate the international aspect, and all of Canada, including Montreal, rather than the jazz. That's because, in my experience, you can see more diverse international music at Montreal Jazz than at any other North American festival. There are major stars from other countries, like King Sonny Adey, but also heavy hitters from the U.S., like La India, who earned her title the Princess of Salsa with a potent, inventive knockout of a show. I discovered at the festival that the Latin fusion group Cordero were braver, spunkier, and more funny than their albums. The Wes Lee Band, a group I had never heard of, delivered a fresh variant on Haitian compa that was saucy, irresistible dance music. Finally, at Montreal Jazz, I found out that Cuban-born Luis Murillo Ochoa is not only a charming and warmly cosmopolitan singer, guitarist, and bandleader, but the founder of the Latin scene in Toronto, which I didn't know existed. Yes, I'm a typical American music fan, uninformed about the North. And with tight tour budgets and tight radio formats, it's harder than ever to hear new Canadian performers. The Montreal Festival seems to champion two things, speaking French and being Canadian. It certainly works these days as a worthy forum for locals to reach outsiders. So I also endorse the Montreal Jazz Festival for straight pop kicks you won't hear otherwise. I didn't hear a world changer like Neil Young or Joni Mitchell, but anybody alive to big beat fun could enjoy the zany dance rock of the band Creature or the Lost Fingers, who combined Django Reinhardt and dance hits of the 80s.
Pump up the jam, pump it up while your feet are stumping. And the jam is pumping, look ahead, the crowd is jumping. Pump it up a little more, get the party going on the dance floor. See, cause that's where the party's at, you'll find out if you do that.
Ooh, a place to stay. Get your booty on the floor tonight, make my day. Ooh, a place to stay. Get your booty on the floor tonight, make my day. Make my day. My day. Make my day. Make my day.
Pump up the jam.
There were many non-Canadian highlights, particularly Stevie Wonder's glorious free opening concert, sparked by his fervent tributes to Michael Jackson. But I kept coming back to the Northern Natives. The Montreal Jazz Festival showed that Canadian musicians are listening to American pop all the time. Shouldn't we give them at least a little more love and attention in return?
Milo Miles lives in Boston. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Jonathan Minhivar directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Yo tenía una perra fina que cuidaba con esmero. Yo le puse lunita por los blancos de su pelo. La perra se me murió y me dejó nueve perros. Perrito que yo quería y cuidaba con esmero. De los nueve que quedaron, uno se tragó un bizcocho.
Entonces me quedaban ocho.
De los ocho que quedaron, uno se cayó en un brete.
Entonces me quedaban siete.
De los siete que quedaron, uno me lo mató un buey, un buey, un buey.
Entonces me quedaban seis.
De los seis que me quedaron, uno yo le di a Jacinto.
Entonces me quedaban cinco.
De los cinco que quedaron, uno se lo lleva un gato, verá cómo era.
Entonces me quedaban.